Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ed Meese, and I'm going to be serving as moderator of this briefing this morning. This program today is a joint Heritage Foundation and Federalist Society project, which looks at the current legal and policy issues relating to the war against terrorists. This is the first of a series of Heritage and Federalist Society events. The next event will be an all-day event on Capitol Hill, which will take place this spring, and we'll look at detention and interrogation policy and other issues such as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and other similar matters. Today's event looks at the current state of litigation that is related to the war against terrorists and the inextricably intertwined policy choices and legal issues that relate to that. Let me say at the outset that there are certain observations that I think are kind of as an overview to today's discussion. First of all, that we have been, since the 11th of September 2001, engaged in a war. And therefore, this is a little different than the usual situation that confronts us with some of the issues that will be discussed today. The second thing is it's a rather unusual war. It's unusual in the sense that it is not carried out in the normal processes of two armies or several armies opposing each other, but rather it's carried out, as we know, by terrorists, where the enemy picks the place and the time of the battle. There's no battle area in formal terms, as you often have. There's no front lines and rear lines. The battle area is wherever the opponent attacks. Furthermore, the combatants who are against the United States and the other countries allied with us are not in uniform. They do not carry weapons openly. They do not obey the laws of war. And unlike in most military conflicts, they deliberately target civilians. These conditions, then, have set up a number of problems that are not addressed in the normal sense by the laws of war, and have given rise then to a whole series of legal issues, some of which will be discussed today. And finally, let me say, as we talk about litigation, that in the war against terrorists, we have had greater intrusion and intervention by the judicial system than at any time in the history of the country. Because war is by nature a matter usually addressed primarily by the executive branch of the government, with certain concurrent responsibilities in the Constitution of the legislative branch. But up until the current situation, we have never had, or we've had minimal intervention by the courts, usually in an after-the-fact manner in the past, in which they have ratified judicially the actions of the executive. And so that's why we have a rather special situation that we'll be looking into today. Our speakers today are David Rivkin. David is a partner in the Washington office of Baker Hostetler Law Firm. He's also a visiting fellow at the Nixon Center and a contributing editor to the National Review magazine. He is an expert on foreign policy issues and particularly defense issues. He has served in the past in both the George H.W. Bush and the Ronald Reagan administrations, serving there in the White House Counsel's Office, the Office of the Vice President, and the Departments of Justice and Energy. While in the government, he handled a number of national security and constitutional issues, which puts him in good stead to deal with these issues this morning. I could go into a more lengthy description of all that he has done. Suffice it to say that he has been an invaluable contributor to the literature on this subject, and also as a participant in radio, newspaper, and television and other journalistic efforts. Our second panelist is Charles, better known as Cully Stimson. He is a senior legal fellow at the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And he has served in the past as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Detainee Affairs in the Department of Defense during the Bush administration. His prior experience has been as a prosecutor. He has been a defense attorney He is a naval reservist in which he is involved in the Navy JAG Corps. He has had considerable experience also in the Justice Department, so he has a variety of knowledge and background that, again, will be very helpful today. We'd also like to acknowledge two people who have been very responsible for putting this together, David Ray, who has just gotten his coffee here, from the Federalist Society, from the committee that's been involved there, and Dean Reuter from the Federalist Society office, who has also been working on putting this together. David Ripkin will discuss the current appellate cases relating to state secrets, the Almeri case, which talks about whether the president has the authority to detain a United States resident as an unlawful enemy combatant. He'll talk about detainees in Afghanistan and whether they have the ability to challenge their detention and other similar cases. Cully Stimson will talk about the policy actions and the options for the new administration. And this is a time when often occurs when a new administration comes in, they take a look at the policies and processes of the previous administration. And he'll share his ideas regarding the need for a long-term, durable detention framework for future captures. David and Cully will each speak for about 10 minutes, and then we will open it up to questions from the floor. Our first speaker, then, is David Ripkin.
Thanks. Thanks very much, General Meese. Begin by pointing, actually picking up on where he left off. Indeed, the court is involved to an unprecedented degree, unprecedented in the history of any body politic in wartime, and certainly in the history of American government, in the key legal issues bearing upon matters that used to be resolved by the political branches in general and the executive branch in particular. And there, the new administration, not surprisingly, given this record of judicial engagement and activism, which, by the way, has ramped up quite dramatically over 8 years of a Bush presidency, and really the trajectory and the extent of, and we can talk about it a little bit more, but the extent to which the court has sort of moved off the traditional deference and done it really in less than 8 years is remarkable. I mean, I think it's remarkable given where they ended up, but the fact that they got there in not 50 or 60 years, but in eight is quite stunning. So the new administration, not surprisingly, inherited several strands of litigation. The first one, in many respects, is the consequence of the Supreme Court decision in Boumediene that gave Guantanamo, at least Guantanamo detainees and possibly some other folks, habeas rights. And the question is, what do you do with people who go through a habeas process and the district court's decision is that they are not enemy combatants? What are the remedies available to the district court in this case? And the case is styled Kayemba and actually involves the so-called Uyghurs, the Chinese nationals who are also Muslims. There are 17 of them. In fact, the government itself concluded they were no longer enemy combatants. The issue was, again, what do you do with them? At the district court level, Judge Urbina in the District of Columbia ordered that they be released into the United States. The case fundamentally changed its posture at the D.C. Circuit level. We just had a panel's decision let's just say the panel in the 2-1 decision basically struck down Judge Urbina's decision. What's notable here is that the new administration had an opportunity to change course here. If you look at the timelines, and they did not do so. Again, to me, this is an enormously consequential decision. All predictions are in litigation are hazardous, but my guess would be that this decision would not be overturned en banc, which, as you are not lawyers, basically asking the entire D.C. Circuit to weigh in on that. I would also predict, even though it's even more speculative, that the cert would not be granted, since I don't think that the Supreme Court is particularly anxious. This is kind of legal realpolitik. It's not lawyers particularly anxious to crisply and unambiguously order the release of detainees into the United States. It's one thing to have a lower court's do such things, but I don't think they're going to do that. Incidentally, one of the reasons it is such an important issue and it transcends, ladies and gentlemen, the fate of the 17 Uyghurs is because, of course, you go for the habeas process because, you know, various issues relating both to the paucity of information that you gathered in the war zone, but also to the perennial problem that the government has in habeas cases, which is if you beef up your return sufficiently to carry your prima facie case in a second stage, there's a probability that you would have to disgorge this information of defense in the course of discovery. So a lot of people, I think both Colleen and I would expect, and anybody else who looked at it seriously, would their classification as enemy combatants would not be withheld. And the question is, what do you do with them? And since there are many countries where these folks hail from, you cannot send them back because of human rights concerns. The sort of the teaching of Judge Rubina's decision would have been that a lot of them would be released into the United States, and not just the Uyghurs. And I somewhat whimsically suggested that if that became rule of decision that applies to future cases, there would be a new way to get to the United States, whether or not you were a terrorist or enemy combatant and just wanted to come here legally. All you need to do is to surrender to American forces by claiming to be a combatant and change your mind a couple of weeks later and go for a habeas process, and then you'll be released into the United States. That would work very, very poorly, I think. Actually, I'm being whimsical, but it's not a funny situation. The other case that, again, fortunately, the current administration continued the posture of the previous one is styled McCullough. Maybe mispronouncing it, but it has to do with the question of what is the geographical ambit of the constitutionally based habeas that Supreme Court's majority gifted to us in Bermudian. Does it only apply to Guantanamo? Does it apply to other places? I don't have much time, but again, it's interesting how the critics' appetite keeps increasing, because we had this conversation a year ago. I would bet you that at least everybody I debated from a human rights community were always talking about Guantanamo and Guantanamo being unique and really under American control and this lease and everything, but surely wouldn't apply to all four corners of the world. Well, we do have at least the first of the Bagram cases coming before the D.C. Circuit. And we do not have a decision yet, but at least the good news is that the Obama administration is continuing the posture of the previous administration. Incidentally, from a purely intellectual perspective, and again, I'm sort of torn, because I think that limiting the reach of the constitutionally based habeas is a good thing as a policy matter. But frankly speaking, if you read Bermudian carefully, you will see that it's not, majority's opinion is not that tightly limited to Gitmo. If you look at the three factors that the court has adduced, they basically pivot off control, and it's an open question whether our control in Bagram or various other places is fundamentally different from our control in Guantanamo. So it's one of those things, it's almost like the famous statement about definition of pornography. We'll know when we see it, we'll know what control is enough. So it would be interesting to see what the D.C. Circuit decides. This case, in my view, would go to the Supreme Court, so it would be interesting to see what happens. The most important case, the third case, and this is a Supreme Court case, and General Meese briefly alluded to it, that's pending, is styled Al-Mari. The oral argument is coming up. The new administration have not asked, to the best of my knowledge, at least as of yesterday, for the postponement of their oral argument, but has asked for a delay in filing their brief until March 23rd. It will be interesting to see what they say. It is probably the most consequential, ladies and gentlemen, of all cases to come up before the court. It goes way beyond Bermudian and habeas. It goes well beyond, Hamdan and military commissions. It really deals with the fundamental question, does the entire laws of war architecture apply to an individual like Al-Mari, who was present in this country legally and was first pulled into the criminal justice system? The very fact that this question has been certified to the court, and again, in the interest of time, I'll skip the Fourth Circuit litigation history, is very bizarre, because, of course, the matter of fact is we are in a legally cognizable armed conflict. The Supreme Court has said so in several cases, most crisply in Hamdi. The notion that the zone of conflict does not extend to this country is kind of bizarre, both as a factual matter. If you remember, we were attacked on September 11th. We were not attacked in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq, even though we do have attacks against American installations around the world.
but we certainly were attacked here. And the fact that the guy is here legally is kind of irrelevant, because under the traditional laws of war, it's not your citizenship that matters, it's whether or not you belong to an organization that is in a state of, or entity or state that is in a legally cognizable conflict with us. So it's not a good sign from my perspective that the case got the cert. And again, we can talk about it more. And this is really the big enchilada. If a case goes the wrong way, in effect, United States territory would be sort of the one portion of the world where the laws of war paradigm would not apply. Just very briefly, a couple of other things. We do have the question, of course, of what constitutes an enemy combatant. We have a lot of folks taking a very narrow definition, arguing that only people who participate directly in hostilities and not other folks belong in that category. Again, silly. Traditionally, if you look at any organization, traditional military or not, the ratio of shooters to support people is always tilted. You know, so people like quartermasters and individuals who made sales and drove trucks and processed payrolls and whatnot were always considered to be combatants in the unlawful combatant context. You know, people who do in-house forging and ammunition preparation were also considered to be combatants. But the view of many critics is you basically narrow the category to such an extent that hardly anybody qualifies. The reason I mention this, of course, that as we have multiple habeas cases moving forward, one of the issues here is what is the right definition in addition to, is the government marshal the evidence to support this definition? And that's something that bears watching. The last line of cases, also very important, has to do with the efforts by various, individuals who have suffered or their families and next of kin to hold government officials personally responsible. And Bivens-type cases, for those of you who are not lawyers, this is a famous case that sort of created monetary liability for violations of individuals who had their civil rights or their constitutional rights violated by federal officials, and a whole slew of Bivens-type actions brought against various former administration officials, including individuals families of individuals who committed suicide in Guantanamo, and various other things. And the question, of course, is whether or not we'll be able to get around the immunity, which is both, there are traditional sovereign immunity issues, but there's also immunity established in the Military Commissions Act. One of the reasons I think this would be most likely, and I'll stop after this, most difficult issue for the new administration is because they spent a lot of time during the campaign talking about, holding people responsible for their misconduct, and it kind of meshes with the whole idea of truth commission and whatnot. But, I mean, to state the obvious, if you're going to hold government officials liable for acting in their official capacity, then you have enormous impact on policymaking. Let me just stop and offer the following sort of bottom-line conclusion. Despite the enormous appetite judiciary has demonstrated for micromanaging those issues, I think the new administration would have an opportunity to do better, frankly, than the previous one, for reasons that are entirely cynical. I wish I didn't feel this way, but and political, because the courts are so politicized here. However, it's not a guarantee to get there. They have to be very clear that that's what they want. If they speak with a united and robust voice after we go for this review that Colleague is going to talk about now, I think they would do well with the court. There's evidence of discord and disarray and different people in the administration pulling in different direction. Where the courts haven't gotten the bit between their teeth, I think the extent of judicial micromanagement would increase much to the detriment of both the Constitution and this country. Thank you.
General Meese, thank you for your kind introduction. Welcome. David, I'm always intrigued by your comments, and I look forward to the question and answer period. I also want to thank the Federalist Society for joining Heritage in this series. I think the new administration, which is famous for listening, is listening to various groups during this strategic pause that they're taking, and I think these are exactly the right type of events that need to be taking place in public to inform the public dialogue. As you know, the new administration issued a series of executive orders in the first week of its existence. Most of you should know what those executive orders are, but essentially they are dealing with the closure of Gitmo within about a year, ending military commissions, some dealing with the CIA and detention policy in general, and then a review of the Al-Mari case, which David touched on. But I want to highlight some facts and then discuss what I believe are the challenges ahead, and then speak about the issue of how to deal with future captures, which the administration touched on in the executive orders. To many, the executive orders didn't go far enough. There were quote-unquote loopholes in the executive orders, which disappointed some. To others, like me, the executive orders contained within them some flexibility. Clearly, they have not made up their mind where they're going yet, and they're retaining the necessary flexibility that any commander-in-chief should before he knows or she knows all of the answers. Mind you, the Attorney General of the United States went to Gitmo yesterday for the first time. I suspect he was saying to himself, gee, I should have gone earlier. Candidate Obama, Senator Obama, never went to Gitmo. Senator Clinton never went to Gitmo, not to my knowledge. And so you have people who are just getting their feet wet now, and this is why one of the many reasons why it's taking as long as it is to sort the way forward. Remember that candidate Obama said that he wanted to, among other things, end commissions and close Gitmo. Well, with respect to closing Gitmo, we know that he set a one-year timetable, and that's a reasonable period of time if you're going to close Guantanamo in a responsible way, especially given all the challenges to closing it responsibly. But with respect to halting commissions, look at the way they did this. It was awkward at best. To many of us who have practiced in the military justice system, and I suspect the commander here is a JAG, the easiest way to have gone about it is for the commander-in-chief to say, convening authority, withdraw all the charges against the detainees, and we're going to sit back and do this period of introspection. They didn't do that. Instead, he asked the Secretary of Defense to ask a prosecutor, to ask a judge, oh, can I have a continuance? And I, among others, said, well, I guess they really don't understand how independent military judges are, because some judges would say yes, and some judges might say no. And what did we see? The first judge said, okay, you get your little continuance. The next judge said, not a good enough reason. And so then they realized the appropriate mechanism was to have the convening authority simply withdraw all the charges without prejudice. Welcome to Gitmo. Even before the president took office, though, we have seen some hints of how he wants to approach the issue of terrorism. He pledged, quote, to build U.S. capacity and international partnerships to track down, capture, or kill terrorists around the world, unquote. And to some at the time he made that comment, that was simply campaign rhetoric. But to others, it was a clue to his potential future policy choices. And I think that's becoming more the thinking. And here's why I say that. Since the president was sworn in, we've seen further hints that that comment as a candidate is starting to form the basis of their policy going forward. First, President Obama said during his inaugural address that we're at war. So unlike, for instance, the ACLU, who I've debated and enjoyed a dialogue with over the years, who say that we're at war against criminals, President Obama didn't say that during his inaugural address. He said we're at war. Second, the executive orders he signed regarding closing Gitmo and detention interrogation each acknowledge that we are engaged in armed conflict, quote unquote, with non-state actors. That's not a war against criminals. This is a war, one that I think General Meese very astutely summarized. Third, his top lawyers, the Attorney General and the Solicitor General, each testified in their nomination hearings that terrorists can be subjected to military detention, what some have called indefinite detention. His CIA director, Leon Panetta, said the new administration might continue with extraordinary renditions, which, as most of you are aware, were really ramped up during the Clinton administration, and that they are keeping open secret temporary CIA facilities, and that he might even have to go beyond the 19 authorized interrogation techniques listed in the Army Field Manual for certain difficult terrorists. And so I suspect that that's not the type of change some people were looking for, but I believe the reality is that once the new administration has been read into certain programs and started to put their arms around the reality of who this enemy is and the challenge they pose, they see this as we see this as the beginning stages of the right way forward. Now, when I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary in charge of detainee policy, we looked at how to close Gitmo, specifically where to put those detainees here in the United States, if that was what the President ordered at the time. This is back in 2006. And, of course, the study is classified. But let me comment generally about some challenges to closing Guantanamo, which the new administration is running into on a daily basis. And they fall into four categories. I call them LLPD, legal, logistical, political, and diplomatic. And as I predicted at the time when the new president was first elected in November, they are quickly realizing that they don't have the luxury of working on each of those four baskets of challenges independent of each other or in order, in any particular order. They have to work on all of them at the same time because each is inextricably intertwined with the other. And I can go into more detail what those specific challenges are in those four baskets during the question and answer period. But far beyond those issues, which is difficult enough, is the issue that the new administration hasn't publicly touched on. They've referenced it in their executive orders, but they haven't spelled out a policy, and we shouldn't expect them to until this strategic pause period is over with. And that is, how do you deal with future captures outside of Afghanistan? It seems reasonable, does it not, that if you're going to surge 17,000 troops into Afghanistan in a hot war zone, where things, according to many supporters of Obama, have gotten out of control and we've taken our eye off the ball by going to Iraq instead of Afghanistan, it seems logical that you're going to want to continue with the law of war paradigm with respect to the detention and incapacitation of enemy combatants, as opposed to treating it as a big crime scene and rolling out the yellow crime tape. And so that's probably why, one of the many reasons why the administration stuck with the previous administration's policy with respect to the Bagram detainees and the fact that they believe that those detainees don't have, shouldn't have access to U.S. courts. And I don't. A lot of people were surprised or disappointed at the administration's response. I was neither. In going forward with how you deal with future captures, they have to do a number of things, and I think they are. First is they have to craft their overall approach to counterterrorism and terrorism in general. Second, military detention fits into that, but only in a way that makes sense after you craft the overall policy. Third, they have the opportunity, I believe, to build on the rationale, the legal and the policy underpinnings on the entire framework regarding how to hold accountable and incapacitate terrorists. Recall that one of the key recommendations of the 9/11 Commission report was for the U.S. to, quote, engage our allies and develop a common approach to the detention and humane treatment of captured terrorists, unquote. Fourth, they must craft a detention framework that allows us to detain the enemy and lawfully interrogate them, all the while upholding the rule of law, human rights, and adhering to the applicable provisions of the Geneva Conventions. It's doable, but it requires a heavy lift. I've prepared numerous papers in the past, one of which was one that David and I and his partner Lee Casey wrote last week on what does Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions mean, and I encourage you to pick it up on the table outside. A week before that, with the assistance of General Meese and others at Heritage and others outside of Heritage, I put together a policy proposal for how you deal with future captures, and I call it Geneva Plus. And that is this. The following procedural protections, I believe, would satisfy, I believe, the administration's belief that we're at war, the administration's desire to put the U.S. On a firmer footing going forward with respect to detention. Understand that military detention is not some right-wing proposition. Military detention is something that is embraced by both sides of the aisle. Look at, for instance, Senator Dianne Feinstein's bill, Senate Bill 147. Calls for the closure of Gitmo, transfer, prosecution of people, but for those who can't fall in either category, in Section 3B5 of the bill, it mentions holding people consistent with the law of armed conflict. And so this is a bill sponsored by Wyden, Whitehouse, and Rockefeller. Even the International Committee of the Red Cross recognizes the right of a state to hold people in non-international armed conflict or for imperative reasons of security. And I refer you to a paper by one of their legal advisors, Jelena Pejic, back in 2005. The reference is included in my paper on future protections, on future captures. But here is, I believe, a reasonable way forward for future captures. One, the Bush administration did not do this, but I think this is proper and necessary. One, for future captures outside of Afghanistan, you should give the person detained an Article 5-style hearing at or near the point of capture. The hearing officer should have the ability to detain or release the person at the conclusion of the hearing. And for those who have been involved in Article 5 tribunals, and I suspect the colonels old enough to have been around during the Gulf War, we've held them before. They don't take very long, but it is what Geneva envisions. Secondly, we have to be able to lawfully interrogate folks. This is a different type of war, as General Meese said. Intelligence is key to defeating this enemy. So there needs to be a period of lawful interrogation if the person is deemed detainable after the Article 5 style hearing at or near the point of capture, but the period needs to be defined. Next, there needs to be an Article 5 style competent tribunal proceeding after a period of lawful interrogation. That needs to be held before a military judge. The detainee should have assistance of free military and qualified counsel, and the military judge should conduct a full and fair hearing. The judge, at that point, has to have the ability to release or detain at the conclusion of the hearing, and the person who is detained for periodic review should have an automatic right of appeal. He's obviously detained pending periodic review and should be provided qualified free appellate counsel. Military detention should not be used for anyone who cannot be safely prosecuted. And we can debate what form is appropriate, et cetera, during the question and answer period. But there needs to be an initial decision early on in the detention matrix to decide, is this person somebody we want to prosecute, or is this somebody who cannot be prosecuted for obvious reasons and should be subject to military detention? But there are open questions even with this proposed framework. And I go into much more detail in my future capture detention framework paper, which is also available in the back. What type of judicial entity acts as appellate review? The FISA court? Does it transfer to a federal district court judge? Many are skeptical of the need for that. Does it fall into then the national security court that some envision being put together? These are all questions that the new administration needs to sort through. But suffice to say that if we take candidate Obama at his word, that he wants to capture or kill terrorists around the world, in other words, take the fight to the enemy, there will be a need, of course, for a military detention framework for some small number of them. So thank you very much. Look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Cully. At this point, we will open it up for questions from the floor. Do I see a hand? But Colonel?
This could be for either one, but maybe for Mr. Rifkin. In terms of the discussion of how broad or narrow the definition should be for an enemy combatant, is there any relationship in forming that definition to the notion of direct participation of hostilities as it relates to civilians? The reason I'm asking that question is, as it's being debated and discussed, part of the concern is how it says the definition might apply to our own civilians or contractors who are ever increasing numbers joining our ranks and taking part in operations around the world.
Yeah, it's a good question. A couple of answers. First of all, I mean, I know that there is a certain degree of exuberance that we've seen in the last several years in suggesting a broader definition, particularly with language about conspiracy and material support, that I think all of us who care about the laws of war understand does not belong in this category. So I call it, you know, the overly broad exuberance. The problem, frankly, the bigger problem has been the push for overly narrow definitions that would exclude too many folks. The answer is, I mean, to me, actually, and I've debated this back and forth privately, I'll just say this with some of my good friends from ICRC, there's nothing particularly new about this problem. From my perspective, what matters is not whether you as an individual directly participate in hostilities, but whether or not you belong to an organization that is involved in hostilities. It's essentially an institutional question. If you belong to an entity that is an enemy combatant entity, and you belong to a sufficient degree in the agency law, all analogies are imperfect, but not a bad analogy looking at it, then clearly you're an enemy combatant. And my sort of favorite parable here is this. If you are a forger similar to the guy in the Day of Ajaccio, you're a commercial forger, you forge documents for all comers, and you forge the documents for Al-Qaeda, you're clearly not an enemy combatant. If you're an in-house forger the way that, you know, Abwehr, German military intelligence had forgers, or, you know, Gestapo had forgers, whose job is to outfit, you know, your men, then you send them on missions, and then clearly you're an enemy combatant. If you are a, you know, money laundering guy who launders money for the mafia one day and for Al-Qaeda tomorrow, you're not an enemy combatant. If you're an in-house dedicated Al-Qaeda financier, then you are. And again, there's nothing remarkable about it. There's nothing unusual about it. That's how it's always been, because if you look at, I mean, what you basically do is you look and see what kind of role you play in the organization. And there are obviously roles that are a little different in the unlawful combatant entity category versus lawful one. But to me, it essentially is an institutional relationship that matters. And all the stories about, you know, and some unfortunate answers about proverbial Swiss grandmothers and material support do not play into it. But again, to emphasize, the real danger from my perspective is not an overly broad definition. It's a ridiculously narrow definition that would exclude most folks. Again, another example, if you are a sympathizer and you invited somebody to stay in your house and you know that they're Al-Qaeda members, that does not make you an Al-Qaeda member. You may be prosecuted in the criminal statute for providing material support. But if you run a safe house for Al-Qaeda, if you're in their roles, even if it's not perfectly manifested, but that's an evidentiary issue because they don't keep the roles that way, then you are, and again, frankly speaking, I don't think there's any disagreement on that issue because I ran this very hypothetical by some ICRC folks. So if you are a professional operator of a safe house, you're a member of Al-Qaeda, you're an enemy combatant. The fact that you never fired a shot in anger doesn't factor into this. There are plenty of people in the regular military who don't know how to fire or, you know, fired a shot in anger. Go ahead.
If I may follow up, is there any relationship to that definition with direct civilian participation in hostilities? The reason I ask that is because it may determine whether the person who is captured is otherwise prosecutable or not. And that's what I'm referring to. I mean, without a doubt, the scenarios you posed indicate that they're part of the fight and therefore should be taken out of it, whether through detention or targeting or some other means. But if they're captured, are they prosecutable because they've directly participated in the hostilities?
Oh, yes, they are. Well,
We'll see if Kali agree and I agree on this as we're agreeing on so many issues. But this is, of course, another, for those of you who are sort of not into it, sort of another almost Talmudic dispute in, triggered by Protocol 1 and various other unfortunate emanations. But the real issue is this. You know, are you a civilian? Are you a combatant? If you are, again, if in my view, if you're a member of an enemy combatant entity, whether or not you personally participated in combat does not matter. It does not signify. You could be prosecuted as an enemy combatant by the sheer fact that you belong. Let's say you're a recruit. You took the bayat. You went for basic training. Before you got to your, you know, post, you got captured. What you've done personally or haven't done is irrelevant. As long as you're a member of Al-Qaeda, you can be held for duration of hostilities. You can also be prosecuted for your membership in Al-Qaeda because being an unlawful combatant traditionally and historically has been a status offense. It's not a question of conspiracy. You cannot belong to an unlawful enemy combatant entity. It is a per se a war crime.
Let me pose then a hypothetical that we would be worried about from the perspective of U.S. forces. We have civilian contractors that fly unmanned aerial vehicles that get real-time intelligence and so forth. If they're captured, can they be prosecuted, therefore, by the enemy?
Yes. I've faced this question a number of occasions, typically in the context of special forces people. And let's be honest, if you are participating in hostilities, and you're not complying at least with the four criteria, or fifth criteria, gone by the wayside, wouldn't be relevant here. And so if you're a special forces guy and you're pretending to be an Afghan woman or an elderly tribesman, I'm sorry to say you are an unlawful combatant and you're liable to be prosecuted on that basis. That is the way things work. On the other hand, if you look at what happens to our guys who get captured, the fact that they be classified as unlawful combatant is the least of their problems. But again, if you take the law seriously, you have to apply it objectively. But my pitch on that is this. We are facing the biggest challenge to the integrity of the legal architecture, the laws of war, but also to this country in an existentialist sense. Maybe I'm too panicky, but I really believe in it. From what? From unlawful combatancy. We have to rigorously uphold the distinction between lawful and unlawful combatancy. We have to delegitimize and stigmatize it. And if that means that some of our guys, a very small percentage, and by the way, when I talked about it with some people in special forces who tell me, but most of them do not pretend to be elderly tribesmen. Because remember, you don't have to have a Napoleon Grenadier uniform. You can have a fairly, if you bear your arms openly, have a discernible chain of command, you make an institutional commitment to comply with the laws and customs of war. The only question is, do you look like a military guy versus a civilian? And most of them do look like military guys. So maybe it's one of those things that is exceedingly rare. But, I mean, look. It's like the question, you know, can spy and saboteurs be treated as enemy combatants? Yes, well, we also always had spies and saboteurs in war. That's how things work, in my opinion.
And Colonel, we see, let me approach, I'm not going to disagree with David, I'm just going to take the answer to your question in a different place. We see the answer to your question, or at least partial answer to your question, in the following two vehicles. MEJA, right? And the SOFA that we just signed in Iraq. The concern is, among other things, what about these civilian contractors accompanying the forces? The question of whether Blackwater, at first, under the original MEJA, Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, was accompanying the force, or since they were strictly contracted to the State Department, not accompanying the force, and simply acting in defensive operations in support of State Department and other personnel visiting Iraq. But if you followed the, I don't know if you were on the review team or the negotiation team in Iraq when we were crafting the SOFA last year, but you know one of the big sticking points was at what point will U.S. personnel or other contractor personnel out of uniform accompanying the force be subject to liability for ultra-virus acts they commit in country. And we can debate whether the SOFA worked out well for military or whether it didn't work out well for them or whether it worked out well for contractors or not. And clearly there's this whole jurisdictional question now in the Blackwater shooter cases from Nasser Square in September 2007 about whether MEJA was even in place, even given the amendments to MEJA. But there's one thing for sure. Al-Qaeda doesn't sign SOFAs. They don't have a MEJA. And so they're going to treat people they capture in an inhumane and deadly public way. But I think you ask a good question, but I think part of the answer to the question plays out in these legal vehicles, these vehicles that have been signed and put into place.
Let me just add one thing. I sort of unintentionally sidestep your question about a contractor situation, and colleague is absolutely right. The way the administration, previous administration, chose to parse the question of immunity obviously suggests that some individuals are not viewed as combatants. But you ask a more interesting question. What about a guy who, you know, lives near Fort, well, forget the location, but let's just say drives from home to work and basically operates a Predator and sitting in a room somewhere, the person clearly uses deadly force and clearly participates in what would we would call combatant activities. And let's say this person violates a principle of distinction, which is it's not collateral damage, it's fires in the convoy of people. But he knows to be civilian types and therefore is a person committing a war crime. In my personal opinion, and again, if he's sitting here, it's nothing to do with SOFA. In my view, if a person is engaged in such activities, he is indeed a combatant. Whether that view is shared by the Defense Department, to be honest, I'm not sure. But that's a very, I mean, a Predator operator is a very clear-cut case. It is not a security guard, you know, accompanying a convoy in a green zone or something like that.
An interesting side comment. If I remember correctly, I think I saw an article in which the people who operated the Predators were trying to seek certain combat benefits. That in itself might be an indication of what you're talking about.
Actually, I mean, not to spend all the time in the general, but I'm sure warrior. I never served in combat, but I imagine it would not be such a silly desire because stress of combat doesn't just come from people shooting at you; it comes from killing people and suffering. I mean, some people poo-poo it, you know, post-combat stress. So if you're sitting here and you're operating a Predator and you're killing people, you may well experience the kind of stress of combat other people who do it on a battlefield, so maybe you should qualify for these benefits.
Okay, over here.
Going to the discussion of Bagram and the efforts to further expand habeas rights for non-U.S. citizens, I mean, Judge Bates as hearing was very clearly distressed by the prospects of letting habeas go to the four corners of the world. I mean, but at the same time, he kind of seemed to indicate that he was amenable to the positions of the petitioners in a sense. Reading whatever tea leaves that you're based on your observations and the interventions of the court to date on these issues, do either of you have any thoughts as to how you think Bagram will play out?
First off, it's interesting, and I don't know if you have a military haircut, I don't know if you've served or been in court, but typically judges don't ask the administration which way they're going. But that's exactly what Judge Bates was teasing out soon after the Obama administration came into office. And essentially, they said to the new Justice Department counsel, do you guys want to tweak with this definition of unlawful enemy combatant? Get back to us. You know, get back to me and let me know. And I'll just sit back and wait. I mean, it's a dialogue. Typically, dialogues occur when they write their opinion. So it was unorthodox, to say the least. I think it's too early to tell, to be quite honest. And maybe David and I or the general might disagree. Clearly, the statement filed by the Justice Department last week saying we're going to stick with the old game plan is clear to some. It may just be that they got enough on their plate dealing with Gitmo and all the other reviews that are happening, and they've created a space for themselves to revisit the issue, or actually visit the issue for the first time later on down the road. I would think that at the least you'll see some window dressing of change in Bagram. Perhaps the ICRC will be given even more access to detainees there. Perhaps they'll ramp up family visits. Perhaps they'll be allowed to make phone calls, if that's even possible, logistically, on a more frequent basis. But I think for now the position of the administration is we'll stick with the former administration's position, but I think it's too early to tell whether they're going to have a wholesale revision of it. I would think, though, as a military man, knowing the military officers in senior positions in the Pentagon, that there would be a big pushback from uniformed officers in the military if they tried to adopt the Iraq approach now, which is you've got to get a warrant to arrest anybody, to detain them, and turn it into a huge crime scene. I just don't think that the senior leadership, the senior JAGs, and the non-JAG senior uniformed leadership in the Pentagon is going to, on the one hand, get half the troops they want, but still get 17,000 troops to surge, and yet at the same time have to treat it like the 5th District here in D.C. and send out military officers and enlisted folks and basically play police officer. So I think it's too early to tell.
Let me just add to this, which my colleague focuses on the battlefield, but we unfortunately have a battlefield in the courts, too, in fact. I mean, I'm not going to get into lawfare and all this other stuff, but I'm both optimistic and a little cynical. The new administration, I'm going to repeat and embellish slightly what I said earlier, the new administration is starting with an enormous reservoir of goodwill. You have basically the conservative faction among Article III judges who think that the courts do not belong in this battle space, who are going to stick with their positions. And you have the somewhat politically motivated faction that is, again, starting with tremendous reservoir of sympathy for the new administration. The problem we have is that, if you read carefully, it deserves to be read carefully, Judge Kennedy's opinion in Boumediene, if the law means anything, it clearly is not Gitmo-centric, because if you go for watch for the factors, I mean, citizenship or nationality and various other things, it's control, control, control. The reference to the practical problems posed by extending habeas, it will be judged, obviously, by the court. And this is the very same court, ladies and gentlemen, that said that in Eisentrager, the practical difficulties of according people habeas in a post-World War II Germany were less than according folks habeas in Guantanamo, which is such a manifestly absurd result that I would not put much trust there. So they left open the possibility of extending habeas everywhere in the world where the United States has operational control, because let's face it, the way we fight, we tend to have operational control over places we detain people. If we don't, it's a, you know, Tet Offensive type scenario that's hopefully temporary. Now, if you want to be cynical about it, they lay down this marker, and they're basically saying to any executive branch, you do things we like in those areas, and we're not going to extend it. But if you don't, we will. How much is enough to keep them happy is shall we say, a never-ending process. It's almost like having a political dialogue with Congress. You know, the fact that they agreed to buy into us today does not mean they're going to agree to buy into tomorrow. It's a hell of a way to fight the war, but that's where we are. The only other thing I would add is we almost have a paradoxical situation where we're extending the constitutional reach, just not only in the habeas side, because, of course, in my point about the Bivenstadt cases, because you know, there's nothing sacred about the Great Writ. It doesn't say in the Constitution that the Great Writ is fundamentally, you know, paramount constitutionally, but all the other provisions in the Bill of Rights are not. So we're really talking about extending not just the habeas, which is a procedural thing, but substantive constitutional protections, potentially the four corners of the world. And yet, if you look into the logic of Al-Mari and the way it was driven by the interest groups, is there will be one huge area that is essentially immune from the laws of war, and that's the United States. And what does it tell us, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you, you know, and I used to, as I said, I'm an armchair warrior, but I used to be a defense analyst. You're creating an enormous incentive for the other guy to come here, because if you come here, you're tremendously advantaged because the laws of war would not apply here. So if those two trends work in an unfortunate direction, with a constitutional habeas and other constitutional protections being extended to four corners of the world, hampering our combat operations, while finding yourself here immunizes you from the laws of war-based architecture, and
makes you, you know, subject to a criminal justice paradigm. That's a very, very bad situation. Hopefully it would not happen.
Roger.
Yes, David.
Here's the mic.
David, with respect to the larger issue of law of war versus law enforcement paradigm, those of us who think that the war on terror should be fought under the law of war paradigm have the most difficulty when the person at issue is a citizen arrested in this country. You said that under the law of war paradigm, citizen isn't the issue. Belonging is the issue, whether you belong to the group or not. But in a way, that's a circular argument because it presumes that you're working under the law of war to work that distinction. Where do you see this issue going? It seems to me this is the weakest part of the those of us who want to argue the law of war paradigm when you're dealing with a citizen captured in the United States or even a legal resident arrested or captured in the United States and saying that this person should not be tried in an Article III court but should be tried under the rules of the law of war.
With respect, in some, and as usually defended the previous administration quite robustly, as a matter of fact, but I blame them for having a bit of a tin ear when it comes to the legal / PR rhetoric. It's not a war against terror. You're absolutely right. When we're talking about war against terror, and I don't even use the word terrorists, I'm not going to avoid it. It's treated under the criminal justice paradigm. It's not a war against terror. It's a war, or let's call it armed conflict, legally cognizable armed conflict against specific entities, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and affiliated entities. And there are all sorts of tests, very old tests, as to what level of intensity of combat is sufficient to trigger a state of legally cognizable armed conflict. Once you trigger that state, and I don't know many people who disagree, certainly ICRC doesn't, that what happened on September 11 was not some, you know, bank robbery or Timothy McVeigh type, you know, blowing up Murrah building. That triggered an armed conflict. Then, and again, was invented by Bush or Cheney or even David Addington. It goes on and on and on, and you may not have to have a formal surrender on a battleship deck in the, you know, Tokyo Bay or somewhere in the woods outside of Paris, but they're tests in sort of historical laws of war. It basically, armed conflict goes on until you reduce the ability of the enemy to offer effective resistance. Maybe difficult to define it precisely, but at least it exists. So in between those two timelines, you commence armed conflict, or it was commenced upon you by intensity of violence. You either have the other side surrender or reduce the ability to offer effective resistance. Between those two goalposts, you have a state of armed conflict. While you're between those two goalposts, whoever belongs to an enemy combatant entity, whoever found on U.S. soil or somewhere else, is an enemy combatant, and citizenship is irrelevant. And that is not for nothing new. I mean, I hate to point out such obvious things, but if you look at Quirin, at least one of the individuals involved was a U.S. citizen. There are all sorts of quotations I can show you from British cases, you know, circa 19th and 20th century, and stand for the proposition it doesn't matter. I mean, you have separate problems if you're a citizen and you're listed in the enemy country, may be accused of various other things, but it has nothing to do with your status as an enemy combatant. Now, you would probably say to me, so the most difficult argument is this. Well, look, the chances of error are high when you deal with unlawful combatants, precisely because of how they operate. And the chances of error are particularly pernicious from a constitutional perspective if you're doing to your own citizens as a matter of policy. Okay, I will buy that, but wouldn't you have to buy the notion that the bad guys are trying to fight here? We're not talking about, you know, again, we were attacked here on September 11. They're seeking to attack us here again. So in some sense, the special regime that, as a matter of policy, you want to create for citizens or permanent residents captured on American soil, driven by the libertarian civil liberty impulse, has to be offset by the fact that if your regime is unduly robust in protecting individual liberty, you're going to cause a lot of people to be slaughtered here, which last time I checked, public safety is not just an abstraction. You have a civil right to be protected, so you would not die or perish. So I'm not, and ladies and gentlemen, the procedures we have adopted in this conflict are unprecedentedly tilted towards civil liberty, more so in any conflict in American history. That was the last time we have habeas petitions. Even before Boumediene, we've had, you know, driven by you know, the very first case, Hamdi, even before we got to the Supreme Court, at the time we were in the Eastern District. What was the last time in American history we had Article III courts weighing in, not as General Meese mentioned, and Kali, after the conflict, but during the darn conflict? I don't know how much more you can push the pendulum without gutting the whole paradigm. And it's and if we're going to call it the laws of war paradigm, it has a distinctive grammar. It means something. It's not just a label. If we're going to go for a level of due process that is analogous to that in the criminal justice system, then it ain't laws of war paradigm, because it has due process, but it's a different type of due process. It's not the same. So it's not that I'm insensitive to a concern. I mean, do you think we're not slicing it well enough now in terms of protecting liberty with all the judicial interventions?
I'm not suggesting that I'm asking you for a response to give to those of our suggestions.
And Roger, there's another, let me take it a different direction. Bless you. Let's assume for the sake of my comments that Obama carries through on his promise to close Gitmo within a year, and some number of these detainees come to the United States and are incarcerated in a federal or military facility. And I think that's a reasonable assumption that that's going to happen. And let's also further assume, for the sake of this discussion, that some number of sleeper cells presently in the United States activate upon learning that KSM or Ramzi bin al-Shib or Hambali or some of these other bad guys are at a certain facility. And they concoct a series of terrorist attacks, including an attempt to break them out of there, or at least a feigned attempt to break them out. Many would argue that you need to stick with the criminal law paradigm, and that is appropriate. I think a lot of people, including military, depending on how big their operation is, would say, well, you know, this distinction of wet foot, dry foot, which is essentially what you're talking about. If you're outside the United States, you get to be an enemy combatant. If you're inside, no, you're just a garden variety Joe Schmo defendant, is irrelevant. What if there are 500 sleeper cells in the United States? What if there's 50? Is it a matter of scale? I mean, Ben Witties, in his excellent book, Law and the Long War, discusses this, I think, at length in Chapter 6, and says, really, Al-Mari is the outlier. You don't create detention policy based on al-Mari, because for now we only know of one al-Mari, at least publicly discussed. But what you multiply al-Mari by 50 or 300 or 500 when these sleeper cells arise, when you take these guys to Leavenworth or wherever they're considering bringing them. And so I think for a lot of people that's when it becomes real. But I hope the administration doesn't wait until it becomes real to recognize. And we'll have some further guidance on where they're going next month when they file their papers.
Let me just raise one thing, and again, I may be worried too much about symbolism and sort of the more existentialist side of it, perhaps consequence of being brought up by the Jesuits at Georgetown. But to me, there, aside from utilitarian sort of imperatives, is it 500 guys? Because you can probably deal with al-Mari as a utilitarian matter in the criminal justice paradigm. Let's keep in mind what our challenge is. Much of the rest of the world, ladies and gentlemen, rejects laws of war-based paradigm, line, hook, and sinker. I mean, you didn't make the front pages of many papers. It was sort of page 4 or 5, but just a few days ago, there's this report about some esteemed commission of international jurists that came out very emphatically in favor of the proposition. We hear a lot of it here from the critics that you cannot have an armed conflict between, certainly not between a state and a private group, so, which basically means group can wage war against us, we cannot wage war against them. To me, we need to be defending robustly, even if there are no sleeper cells here, the notion that this is war. And we have to apply the laws of war paradigm, both here and overseas. If we try to split the baby in half, if we only apply it overseas, if we do it in a kind of a, as if we're slightly ashamed about it, as if I
mentioned this in the piece I did for Wall Street Journal. If we treat the laws of war paradigm as a crazy uncle in the attic, we will lose the debate with a side, most of whom are allies, that don't want it applied at all. And that way lies national security disaster. So we have to, hopefully the new administration will do it, because, again, they're starting with a lot of wind in their sail, would continue, Roger, to apply it to the U.S., if for no other reason than this symbolic lawfare-type exercise. Again, I repeat, even if we have no sleeper cells here at all, just because if we don't do it, we will lose this war.
Yes, in the back.
Thank you. My question is actually for Mr. Rivkin. In turning your attention to the Al-Mari decision upcoming, specifically to the case facts pertaining to that case, what precedents do you predict they might cite on either side? And would something like Ex parte Milligan even apply in something like this, where it's kind of already been determined that military tribunals cannot be done in specific zones of conflict?
Well, the good news, very briefly, and I don't know what my colleague thinks about it. The good news is, and I'm fairly creative, at least I think I could envision what the court would do before I read Bermudian. I don't know what they're going to do. It has nothing to do with Milligan, and Ex parte Milligan is my favorite case, which of course stands for the proposition that that a civilian cannot be tried by military commissions. But this is not, Milligan never dealt with the question of can you be a combatant if you're lawfully in the United States? I mean, that question would have struck people at the time as absurd. Of course you could be. It's just that Mr. Milligan was basically a pathetic, loudmouthed civilian type, was not a combatant, and there was no real insurgency where he was based, unlike some other places in Missouri, for example. I don't know what the court is going to say here in order to justify the position they're adopting. You have some enormously bad language in the Fourth Circuit, which again stands for a proposition which goes beyond where even ICRC is, that literally you cannot be in a state of armed conflict unless you are a state, which again is, I mean, bizarre. It used to be, by the way, that there were five criteria for being, a lawful combatant, and one of them had to involve in fighting the state. So not fighting for the state made you an unlawful combatant. It did not make you a civilian. I don't see the Supreme Court adopting this. On the other hand, they took the bloody cert, and they've done that, by the way, after the November elections. And again, if you want to be totally cynical about it, people like Justice Stevens don't typically vote on granting a cert unless they believe they have a workable majority, which is why, for example, I think they flipped on the Bermudian originally. Remember, they went from no cert to cert. I don't know what they're going to say. It is a mystery, as they say in my favorite movie. And to say that he is here lawfully, I mean, I suppose they can come up with a very narrow decision that pivots off the fact that Mr. Al-Mari was first taken into custody with material witness or credit card fraud or some other thing. But, I mean, what does that have to do with anything? I am enormously troubled by this decision, and I think the administration probably will try to get out of it and try to get Mr. Al-Mari, you know, transferred out of a military justice system the way they've done it with Mr. Padilla. But if I were a betting person, I would predict that his lawyers would not settle for that, and we all understand what the criteria are for, you know, getting the cert dug. I am very worried about this case because I really don't see how they can do it in a way that does not gut the system. But, I mean, does anybody?
Kelly, do you want to comment?
Well, you're asking us to play Miss Cleo, so I'll try a little bit and look in my crystal ball. it was not a surprise to me when I was the head of detainee affairs in the summer of 2006 to see Hamdan come down the way it did. I mean, if you look at the arc of the cases, starting with the very first case to where we were in the summer of 2006, I mean, it was fairly predictable to a lot of us. Where it was going. And sadly, I have to admit I was not surprised where Bermudian went. and that, I think, is a continuation of that arc. But I do think, and David stole my thunder a little bit, I do think that the administration may try to resolve this by alternatively disposing of Mr. Al-Mari through a civil, get him to another country, you know, do something like that. But I don't think the case is going to go away. Jonathan Hafitz, who's his attorney, who I've debated and we enjoy a dialogue together, he's going to say the issue's not moot. We have to move forward. It needs to be decided. The proposition still stands. The OMF is there. All the reasons are there. Just the body's not there. And I think David's right. I think it would be difficult to derail this. I don't know if I'm as cynical as David, but then again, I haven't done all the appellate work David's done over the years. I'm a trial lawyer at heart, so I'll defer to David and others who have more appellate experience.
Thank you, Kelly. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, I mean, the issue in Omari is presented in Gross. It's not a question of fact, because precisely the Supreme Court took the cert instead of letting the case drop down to the habeas-style petition. So, the way that the question is phrased is particularly unfortunate, but that's because that's what happens at this stage, because they borrowed the question, the formulation from the cert petition. But, I mean, it is basically the question of can you be an enemy combatant if you're a fellow like Omari, assuming that the government allegations are correct, namely that he's a member of Al-Qaeda because he's present in this country lawfully. I really do not know how they're going to deal with this case if it comes to the point of writing a decision.
Another question? In the absence of a question, I'll ask the last question then. You have not mentioned much about military commissions. What do you see as the future of military commissions, or how will these determinations, what kind of a process? There's a process in place now for status review as well as for military commissions. How do you see this all working out?
Nothing like your boss asking you a question in a public forum. No, it's a good question, General Meese. I think commissions as we know them, as they're currently constituted, are dead, and they've been dead for a while. And by the way, now Obama owns commissions. His commissions are about as successful as the Bush commissions. He has no convictions, yet he still has commissions. He could have ended the commissions process. They're dormant now. I think there's been a fairly quick change of thinking inside the administration with respect to commissions. I think at first, they were open to the idea of upgrading the commissions. And as those of you who followed commissions know, the Secretary of Defense actually has the sole authority to change the implementing rules. And I think there was a thought process early on that perhaps you could upgrade the rules for military commissions, make them virtually identical to courts-martial, minus a few practical rules like the prohibition against the admission of hearsay and that sort of thing. And then march forward. But I think that died on the vine quietly inside the administration. And I think they're right now wrestling with what I believe is the crux of the problem. Does Federal Rule of Evidence 505 provide too much potential evidence, expose too much classified evidence for the world to see? And then are we giving unlawful alien enemy combatants the same rights as a typical defendant here in the United States would enjoy under our Constitution, and can that be done fairly? There's an internecine war going on now in the administration. Some believe Article III courts are the sine qua non, the be-all and end-all. Others believe that for some low-level combatants who have committed articulable war crimes, they can be tried in a standard courts-martial with some minor modifications. I think it's too early to tell. I will say once again that although I'm proud to be in the JAG Corps and have wonderful relationships with many of my former students who are defense attorneys and prosecutors, most JAGs aren't qualified to try long, complicated national security cases. A two-week case in the JAG Corps, a three-week case in the JAG Corps is a long case. It's unheard of to try a case of 9 months with a million documents and 500 witnesses. We just don't do that. So I think they realize that. So you may see some courts-martial for terrorists with JAGs taking the lead, but these will be relatively simple cases where there's not a lot of classified information. and I think it remains to be seen whether they'll wholly embrace federal district court for the remainder. So I think it's too early to tell who's going to be the victor inside the administration in terms of the argument. But I think that if you're going to go to Vegas on this, I think you should put your chips on federal district court.
Let me just add to this a little bit, and again, I'm probably being somewhat doctrinally pure here, but back to the point that, you know, we have a laws of war paradigm, a legal architecture under assault, and there has to be vigorous defense of it. To me, as important as the Guantanamo population is, which of course now houses the high value 9/11 IRA-related types, it is pales in insignificance of whatever rules on going forward basis. And to me, it's a very simple proposition. If we delegitimize the military justice model on the prosecution side, what we call them, military commissions or enhanced military commissions or special courts martial, and you put folks who are here, who are brought here, which is the Gitmo folks, into the Article III court, a national security court, you deal an irretrievable, deadly blow to the legitimacy of military commissions in the theater of operations. And there's only one thing that's even more implausible. You may, you know, be able to do put people up in a, you know, buried Predominant courthouse here and process them for Article III system, however imperfectly, but you ain't going to be able to do it with thousands of people we hold in detention in the theater in Afghanistan, Iraq, and various other places if this war goes on and on. So we are really talking about the continuing viability of the military prosecution system. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, in my view, I could be wrong, but if you don't do military prosecution, left by itself, a military detention is not going to endure. And so it's all kind of interrelated. The pre-battlefield, you know, laws of war-based application of firepower, the military-style detention, the military-style prosecution, we have all of it worldwide, we don't have any of it. I certainly would not have after a fairly short, by historical standards, period of time. And my last point, not being a JAG, my sort of, again, somewhat cynical message to the JAGs would be this. The JAGs played a great deal of, you know, as they engaged a lot of constructive criticism during the Bush administration. They start now with, operate now with tremendous credibility. It would really behoove them to vigorously defend the military justice paradigm, because quite aside from national security considerations, we're talking about nothing else but their professional survival. Because if we're not going to use the military justice paradigm to deal with our enemies, the days of using the military justice paradigm to deal with our own soldiers are numbered, because nobody, in one of these days, the politicians are going to wake up and say, wait a minute, we're going to be doing Article III for Osama bin Laden, but why not do an Article III court for some schmuck who is accused of drunk driving in Okinawa? So basically, in that world, if we go down that path, the military JAGs would be finished as a profession. There would be nothing left of a military justice system. So I hope there is sufficient appreciation of that fact among the JAGs.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for being with us this morning. We thank our panel. Please join me in thanking the panel, and thanks for being with us.